Testing, testing.
Okay. This is Dave Crippen in another one of our series of oral history interviews with key automotive designers. And today we're speaking with Don De La Rosa, who spent a number of years at Ford and is now an executive stylist at Chrysler Corporation. We'll ask Mr. De La Rosa to tell his story pretty much in his own narrative. And I think we can begin with your school and your earliest influences.
All right. I went to John Herron Art Institute in Indianapolis, where I was born, and studied art over an extended period, not as a full-time program, but as a evening and weekend program, more or less, for several years. I think my interest in automobiles and automobile design was really a function of a natural kind of interest. I think my ability to express myself in the business of design, I think, at the risk of overstating it, I would say to a large degree it was a genuine interest and a natural ability to express myself, which was the ability was enhanced by the good fortune that many of us have in the during our lives. The good fortune in my case being being employed by General Motors when I came to Detroit to interestingly, not launch a career in automobile design, but to start a career in insurance, which I came from an insurance family. My uncle, he put up with me while I was getting situated here. I lived in his home in Dearborn, and he was a manager, one of the managers for AAA. And my inclination when I first came to Detroit was to go into the insurance business, but I think to go through the detail would be a little excessive on how I happened to sidetrack myself into design. But I had, during the time I was living with my uncle, I had the benefit of being introduced to a man who was a automotive supplier down in the Fisher Building. He looked at some of my sketches, which I was doing really as a means of just killing time and enjoying myself. His name was Fred Leeson, and Fred represented, among other companies, a metal stamped art metal that he was used in automobile design at the time, and probably still is. Can't remember the name of the company, but nonetheless, Fred, upon looking at my work, said that asked me the question whether I would be interested in automobile styling, as it was called at the time, and I expressed an interest, and he said that he had the kind of connections that he could make it happen, so. Fred, he said, where would you like to go to work? And I said, well, I'd like to go to work at Ford. the only reason I can think of it, as I think back on it, is that we were kind of a Ford family, and I had been through my uncle's help, had been getting brochures and all kinds of reading material from the Ford's training program that they had at that time, and so he said, "Well, fine. I think there was a chap by the name of Hibbard, Tom Hibbard, who ran Ford, and he says I'll set it up, and you can go out and for an interview, and fine." So my uncle drove me out to Dearborn, and just as a little humorous aside, we walked into the which is I think now called the Triple E building, the old building where engineering building was and where styling was at one end of it and so forth. And we walked in there and waited for a few minutes, and I got a call from the person that was going to interview me. It wasn't Tom Hibbard himself, but one of his representatives. And so I went in for an interview, took my sketches in, and came out. I don't recall how long it was. It was a brief interview. I came out, and I was pretty downhearted. I had flunked. Ford wasn't interested in me. And the humorous side of it was, my uncle had been scolded for smoking cigars in the lobby of the engineering building, which wasn't permissible at all. So he was embarrassed by that.
The old Henry Ford influence.
Yeah, right. So we ended up driving back home, and I was really very disappointed that Ford had turned me down.
What year was that?
That was 1945. As I'd just gotten out of the Air Corps and just had really was getting my myself oriented as far as business and career actions were concerned. So the next day we called Fred and told him of the demise, and he said, "Well, you know, don't give up." He said, "I've got a very good friend, a fellow by the name of Julio Andrade, who was Harley Earl's, one of Harley Earl's principal people. I think he was called chief stylist for Harley Earl. Howard O'Leary was head of administrative work for Harley, but Julio was head of design, as I recall. And so he said, "Oh, I've got it all lined up for you to be interviewed by Mr. Andrade." So I was fine. So I went down there, and of course I got the job, and was thrilled. And of course it really has stayed with me, I think, as a means of impressing upon me the need to not look at things that transpire as necessarily as failures because they don't follow the format that you've judged is the only correct one. Because here's a case where I had the good fortune to work for General Motors. I only stayed there, I think, was slightly less than 2 years, like maybe 20 months or thereabouts. And I worked, my first boss was one of the tops in the business, and I think at that time, and one of the all-time great designers and illustrator, a fellow by the name of Henry DeSigior Love. And Henry Love was the chief designer of our chief stylist of Buick Studio. So I worked for Henry. And then...
Post-war Buicks?
Yes, right. And after a limited period there, it has to be somewhat limited because, as I say, it was from 18 to 20 months limitation. After we'll say approximately a year, approaching a year, I was transferred to the Cadillac studio, and I worked for Bill Mitchell, and a fellow who was a very outstanding designer who had an untimely early death, a fellow by the name of Ed Glowacki, who was one of the I have to recognize my judgment as to the quality of the ability of these people is limited because I didn't have much myself, but in my judgment Ed Glowacki was certainly outstanding. But Mitchell's had a style and that was unique from Henry's, and of course it gave me the opportunity to work and be inspired, work hard, work with reference to examples of work done by real pros in those two instances, and meet a number of very highly qualified young men. And after this 18 to 20 month period, I was given an opportunity, an invitation of sorts, to join George Schneider and a group of people who were coming to Ford Motor Company to start the new Ford Styling Center. And an unusual decision for a young person to make, particularly to leave General Motors, was quite a sizable decision. But anyway, I seemed impressed with the potential opportunity, and of course it was a great opportunity. I think coming from a company like General Motors, it gave me the best address in the city, or in the business, so to speak, and gave me that 18 or 20 month period to observe the real professional ways of expressing yourself in a creative sense. So it was it launched my career, and I remained there at Ford for a total of 31 years until 1978. And had I worked on a number of areas for Bourdonnais very early in the scheme of things was identified as the head of the operation, albeit following George Walker and some others that were in the top role, but Gene came in very early, as I recall it, as vice president of styling.
Could we move you back a bit to the time of the switch from General Motors to? You said that George Schneider was setting up the design center. He was also a GM.
Right. Yes, he was head of. No, he was head I'm not sure what they called it then, whether it was special projects or advanced, but it was not one of the car studios like Pontiac or Chevrolet.
Oswald was
the ranking person. George Schneider reported to Oswald.
You came over then. Did you come over with Gene Bourdonnais at that time?
No, Bourdonnais came over about. I think Gene told me several weeks before maybe a month before I got there. I hadn't known Gene. Gene worked in another area of styling at General Motors than I did, and. And he, of course, had worked at General Motors before the war and prior to going into the Air Corps, he worked in for GM. In fact, I think he spoke of working on some military projects,
tanks,
right?
Yeah.
But I never had the pleasure of meeting Gene at that point in my career. It was all at Ford.
So this is apparently someone has decided to bring over a sizable contingent from
yes,
General Motors.
Right.
Would this have been Ernie Breech or Henry Ford, second?
Well, frankly,
I
never was privy to that, and I don't know. In fact, it's an interesting point. It's kind of of added interest to me because I'm surprised at myself for not being curious about it. You know, it really is a very interesting point because there were relatively few people at Ford, so it was a very serious effort on someone's part to organize the what would later become what Gene made of it. And Gene was a devoted executive and builder of the organization. I think it is a credit to him. I mean, when you consider there were just maybe a half a dozen or so of us, and to build it into what he did was, I thought, very impressive. And
so, in a sense, you're gearing up for the real first post-war cars.
Yes, right.
The new post-war cars.
Right. Yes, they had. Ford had. They had a chap there by the name of Bill Schmidt,
mm-hmm.
And of course Johnny Nager,
mm-hmm. right.
And Herman Brunn, and I'm trying to think the engineers, the body engineer that worked at Styling. You find a German gentleman who actually did the surface development work. Maybe his name will come to me. He actually, I think, developed the means of developing surface in the form that they did for many years until the advent of computers and so forth. Well, anyway, Ford had the new. The new Lincoln Cosmopolitan and the new Mercury, those cars were done when we came there from General Motors, and we had no role in them. They were not cars that I think were consistent with what we judged to be meet the standards that were needed at Ford, but timing being really the dictator there, and the desire to get new cars out on the road, the net result was that those cars were tooled and were offered in the marketplace.
Was Mr. Gregory still there by the time you got there?
No, he wasn't. I heard of him and a lot about him, but his name was Bob, wasn't he? Bob
Eugene,
Gregory.
But Bob.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
No, he was gone.
Was George Walker a consultant by this time?
Yes, he was. We were as I recall, we reported to in reporting to Oswald and George Schneider,
mm-hmm.
this reporting structure came under engineering, as I recall,
yeah.
and we had a criteria and a means of judging the package, the vehicle packaging, and so forth. It was in many instances quite different from George Walker's. Walker was, by comparison, with the help of Elwood and Joe, were by comparison freewheelers, and very capable and very talented, and they in many cases they actually there were many instances where we didn't win, you know. I mean, their candidate was selected and ours wasn't. I remember we at times would privately cry in our beer a little bit over that, the fact that, as someone described it one time, they have an opportunity to come in the building and look at whatever we're doing, but we never had a chance to look at what they were doing.
You were physically separate, weren't you?
Yes,
north
right.
And south wings of the...
Yes, right. And for a period when I first met them, of course, they worked down at the Fisher Building, or
Walker's
headquarters.
Yeah.
But they had they were real strong competitors, and I think from the point of view of the Ford Motor Company, it was a healthy circumstance, even though a bit hard to take to those of us who were Ford employees. But Bourdonnais was a formidable adversary. I think he had a means of getting things straightened around so that there was wasn't a lack of comparative quantity or quality in the two organizations. I think through his direction we did very effective competitive work against the Walker team. And as I say, Gene was a talented executive as well as a designer, and as a result he was a formidable person as far as ensuring that there was equality, you know, so we have him to thank for all of that.
The Walker design was accepted for the 49 Ford as well, wasn't it? Did your team have any input into that?
No.
Almost pretty much been taken care of by the time you got there.
Yeah. In fact, I think I found it very early for me, considering my age. I found myself kind of unimpressed and disappointed with the devotion on the part of many of my peer group, who devoted so much attention to trying to get credit for that car of Walker's.
Right.
I mean, my God, I couldn't believe it. I mean, everybody you met had, is, you know, one chap whose name I don't remember, but he claimed he did it in his kitchen, on the kitchen table. This fellow here, Dick Khalil, he was, would badmouth everybody because he claimed that the fellow I just spoke about, who said he did it in his kitchen, was lying because Dick Khalil said he did the car, you know, and it was actually you could see some humor in it. Mm-hmm. I mean, my God, people were just went crazy trying to get credit for it. And of course,
was Bob Cotto one of that group?
Bob Cotto is the fellow I'm talking about, who was so upset because he said he did it. And here's the other fellow who said he did it. And I'm sure there were others that I never had never heard discuss it. But
well, once that's out of the way and launched, however good it was, you were launched into the early 50s.
Right. Yeah.
Did you concentrate early on the luxury car group, the Lincoln?
Yes, I did. Right. Yes. Yes, I did. In fact, I had brought in an organization chart, a pictorial organization chart here, just because one of my people that works for me in administration is on this chart. And this is back in the early 50s, and there was a period, I don't remember the exact date, but there was a period at which Ford made the decision to separate Lincoln and Mercury division organizations. And at that time, I was given the responsibility for Lincoln. It was the only time in my life I was I was at this same level as Gene Bourdonnais. I mean, in this context of responsibility.
And Gene had what?
He had Mercury, right? You know, it obviously didn't last very long, and it was back to square one, and of course Gene, being the having the decided margin of knowledge and ability and so forth was he sure does have it was unquestionably the choice of the company so it wasn't a surprise to me at all.
What Lincoln early 50s Lincolns did you work on those days?
I worked on the competitor of the famous 61 Continental. We were doing an in-house competitor of Elwood's Continental, which interestingly was designed as a Thunderbird. It wasn't designed as a Lincoln. In fact, representative of what I was talking about as far as package, vehicle package is concerned. We were directed to do a Lincoln that was on a package that was very massive by comparison to this car. And Elwood sold this car. It was really a stroke for him, and his reputation and the company as well. I was named as part of the team that worked on it. It was I was a little amazed at that because it was very nice. I appreciated it, but I. When you look at the plaque that we all receive, the implication is that you were part of the team, and it kind of implies that you were certainly part of it of the team from a creative point of view, and I certainly wasn't. I was part of the team in that it was my responsibility to take this vehicle through the feasibility development and so forth, and really that was the extent of my involvement in
this
it.
This is after the Engle package was accepted?
Yes, right.
Over yours and
right,
Gene Bourdonnais.
Yeah. Right. And
someone tells a story, I wonder if you can corroborate this, that it was McNamara who decided to took a look at Engle's design and said, can you... actually, working on a Thunderbird, I guess.
Yes, he was, right. Yeah,
he said,
was.
Can you stretch it into a Lincoln Continental?
Yes.
Is that
yes, that's
true?
That's my recollection as well.
And you and Gene were working in another studio on a much heavier...
one that would be more like the 59, you remember,
right.
The 59, and the 60 Continentals.
Right.
And those were done by... by Johnny Nager.
Oh yes, uh-huh, right. Moving you back just a moment, did you have any input into the Mark II? Do you remember working on that at all with anyone?
No, the Mark II, that's the William Clay Ford model?
Yeah.
No. My only connection with that that vehicle and that project was that this is kind of I'll tell a story because I think it's kind of interesting, but it's pretty the area the people to whom would find this, you know, to whom this would be interesting are certainly limited, but nonetheless I'll be brief. I was given the opportunity to through an invitation from William Clay Ford to join that organization and be the chief designer. And I discussed it with Jean Bourdonnais, and Jean Bourdonnais expressed an interest in my remaining with him. I think that I had some not certainly well founded, but I had some misgivings about the durability of that organization. I think that, as well as a desire to continue my association with Bourdonnais, influenced me, and I turned William Clay Ford down, which people don't do, you know.
This was the beginnings of the Continental
Studio. Right, that was the beginnings of the Continental Studio. I don't want to have that demean John Reinhardt and make him sound like second choice, but in all honesty, he was, and he's a very capable designer, and he did quite a nice job on it. I'm not terribly enthusiastic about the result. I never was, but I'll leave that to others as far as judging its merits. It was a bit. It had some areas that I thought could have been handled better. Probably I figured that Bourdonnais and I probably could have done a much better one had we been given a chance.
So in lieu of that, you went to work on the 61 Lincoln.
61, yeah.
All new.
Yes, right.
did Mr. Bourdonnais ask you to join that effort?
Yes, he did.
Was he the senior stylist?
Yes, he was, right, yeah. Yeah, we had a number of leaders in the organization. Some of their names I've lost. Leading up to Jean Bourdonnais, preceding him. In fact, we had a very nice chap there who was an administrative person from Ford, who actually ran styling for a limited time up to, and then of course there was the obvious existence of George Walker, and George Walker moved from outside to as a consultant to the inside as a officer in the company, if I remember correctly.
That's correct.
And then he was He departed for reasons that I was never privy to, but he was his departure, I think, as the stories that I had heard that George had, which seemed to make sense to me, knowing George, that he would nominate one of his a member of his team to follow in his tracks, and I think Joe Orris was the person he had selected, and for reasons that I'm not privy to, but for reasons that Ford Motor Company made, they selected Jean Bourdonnais, which was a damn good idea as far as Ford's benefits are concerned, and no slight intended for Joe, but Joe was not in Gene Bourdonnais' league at all. I used to enjoy beating Joe in different design projects regularly, just for the hell of it. He was a fellow who I don't know, seemed to bring that out in me.
Very tense.
Yeah, he was tense, and he was very competitive. And I had a way of assessing where his vulnerability, and so I won a few like that and enjoyed it. I'll have to say, it didn't do anything for me materially, but as a designer, I enjoyed beating his socks off. And,
some people about this time, you were trying to think of Frank Hershey.
Hershey was there.
The administrator, could that have been Charlie Waterhouse?
Charlie Waterhouse, right. Yeah, Charlie was a real gem, mm-hmm. I thought, a very nice fellow.
Yes.
Very nice. And
he's still very much alive.
Oh, is he?
I chatted with him recently.
Oh, how nice. 80 years old. Yeah. Isn't that wonderful? Oh, that's nice.
Well, everybody speaks well of Charlie.
Yeah, he's yeah. Yes, he was a very real gentleman, I think, would be a good description.
Would Vic Raviolo be, at this point, another one of the people you're thinking of?
Yeah, yes. Vic, in fact, as I recall, I think Gene Bourdonnais, I'm not positive of this, but I think Gene Bourdonnais, and as a result, I reported to Vic Raviola.
Mm-hmm.
When we were doing the cars, the Continentals or Lincolns preceding the successful 61 Lincoln of Elwood.
The late 50s.
Yeah, right. In that time frame, Vic was the man.
Right.
And he was quite a strong person as. I think looking back on my career, it's strange that I'd use that term, a strong person. As I look back on my career, the number of executives in leadership, in a leadership role, who exercise their prerogative by virtue of their authority, they number in the dozens, and I watched them come and go. Jack, who was the fellow that I did have a good relationship with, is Jack. He was vice president of Mercury Division.
Jack Reith.
Yeah. Right. I seemed to have the vibes were good between Jack and I, and but the point of that I was making was the number of people that that have the authority, have the position and the kind of authority that can permit them to exercise their judgment, and in many respects, victimize creative people is an appalling part of our business. It's I don't consider that I got took much of a rap, but I was involved in enough of it that it made me a little bit passive about it. In other words, I just sort of took it for granted that they were going to do that, and they did. And it was interesting to me, even though I was that new to the business, that people who have no through education or talent that they're blessed with have nothing going for them really, except their august position in the company. And they can wail away at the creative person, And in that regard, Bourdonnais, of course, was so formidable that he kept he prevented them from, I think, I mean, that's just a singular an opinion, but I judged to a large extent our continuing success and effectiveness to be the result of his capabilities. I think there's no question in my mind that a lesser person just wouldn't have been able to be as effective as we were.
So it was really Gene's ability to bring the design center into being.
Really, it was into being and to present the things that he had caused to take place, the cars that he would review and generally feel it met the criteria that he judged to be the desirable one, and those vehicles we won many shootouts, I think, through his input, and I think, I don't really know, I'd have to spend a lot of time thinking about it. I don't know why it is or why it was, but I spent the majority of my career really outside of the structure of the car divisions. Most of my time was spent in special projects areas. I had the good fortune to work for Bob McGuire, who was really, I think, an outstanding designer and outstanding manager. And
the three of you presented a formidable team, did you not?
Yes, right.
Eugene and Bob McGuire.
Right, yeah. Right. I think we did. I really paid attention and I really learned a lot from McGuire. Between McGuire and Bourdonnais, I think it really was had significant importance to my career. And Bob was very, very unusual, I think, in that he would go out of his way to share his opinion in the form of benefiting the individual through guidance. I think he had that quality of actually helping. He was an unselfish person in that regard, and I think he was good, very, very important person to those of us that needed guidance, and he was very, very effective.
In the late 50s, then, you've got two teams working on the 61 Continental, in effect.
Yes.
The Engel, so-called Engel model, apparently prevailed.
Yes, right.
But input came from all of the group that were working on even
yes.
the other one. So
yes.
So you became really the 61 Lincoln team.
Right. Yes. Right.
And that was a very successful model, as I recall.
Oh, it was. It really was. We the teams. I can't recall what Elwood's whether Elwood departed and came to Chrysler or when he came,
but shortly after that.
Shortly after that, I guess. And as a result, the rest of the team under Bourdonnais, of course, took the responsibility for the vehicle as it progressed through the series. And we we made some changes to it. I remember one of them that Bordenay and I, one thing that Elwood did that was a, we never agreed with, of course, was his tumble home on the car was so severe that you could, you know, I mean, the roof rail was right beside your head, the windshield header was right back here, you couldn't get the sun visors down without having to lean back in your seat. A typical designer kind of thing. I still run into it now and then.
You mentioned, is it called tumble home?
Tumble home.
That's the
right.
Technical term.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I've still had, on occasion, I'll have a designer. I think that they understand me here at Chrysler, so I don't think I have any of them here right now, but I think when I came here, there were people who would move the windshield back to a point that they thought was important, regardless of whether you bumped your head on the header or not. But anyway, Bordenay and I got into that car very early on. I think we started right away, and we straightened the tumble home up and made it. I think we moved it out 2 or 3 inches aside, so it was quite a. It was more in keeping with the class of car, the kind of layout that you would expect with a Lincoln car. God, I didn't realize I talked so slow. Why am I slow?
Not at all. That's good. Were we talking about the 61 Continental?
Right,
point?
Right. We were.
Could you add any comments that you might wish to make about that project? How important it was, or how exciting a project it was, and how it affected your career at Ford, your design career?
Well, I was very excited by Elwood's design. I was amazed at the approval process that took place that really wrote finish to my counter proposal in favor of Elwood's design. I think they made a good decision. I think the only thing that I reservation I had about it was that for all of the drama that it produced in appearance, it did sacrifice some interior package, which I felt was not in the interest of the kind of vehicle that we should be aligning ourselves with at Ford. I think one of the hierarchy of Ford Motor Company at the time, as I recall, it was possibly because I had a tendency, which hasn't really gone away, to say things to people, either make statements or ask questions of people of very high-ranked people. It's a penchant of mine, really. I think at this, as I recall this, I think I was going through one of my typical Della Rosa periods, and it was on my mind, and I asked Earl McPherson about it. That is because I was confused by the whole Lincoln subject as far as Ford Motor Company was concerned. And at the time, as I recall it, Mr. McPherson, I can't remember the thing in total, his reaction, but one of the things that I did preserve was that because I was questioning why would Ford really be doing, at this time of the asking of the question, why would Ford be doing the things like the Mexican road race for the Lincolns? In 1952, I think Ford won the Mexican road race in 1952, 53, 54. That's great, you know. I mean, so, but the thing that I couldn't understand about it is what vehicle is our competition industry wide? I mean, Cadillac isn't, you know, in the racing business. What are we doing in it? At that point, he said to me, we're not building, you know, we're not chasing Cadillac. We don't give a damn about that. That's not intended to be a direct quote, but
right.
It was quite plain that he was very firm in his feeling about that. And he said, Oldsmobile is our competitor. So much for quoting Earl McPherson. The thing that really... It stuck with me because I thought, you know, what the heck? Here's a company that is now one of the key people in the company is saying, oh, we don't, we're not interested in, you know, in Cadillac. We're going to chase Oldsmobile. Well, that attitude prevailed at Ford. For years, they never had a. There was no continuity at all. I had the good fortune to be there in this time frame. I had the good fortune to, you know, to be associated with Jean Bourdonnais, and I like to think I made something of a contribution to this. I'm not taking credit for it, but I think I was a contributor to attacking what Gene, as I recall, shared my feeling of this problem. That is the plowing under of design and the ignoring of design continuity from one year to the next at Lincoln, so that the customer never knew what he could expect from Lincoln. I mean, you had big Lincolns, little Lincoln. Now we're in the you know, as we now have moved to the Elwood Engel, as great a car as it was designed to be a Thunderbird.
Exactly.
But somebody then says, oh no, wait a minute, no, that's a Lincoln. Well,
he tells me it was McNamara.
Oh, well, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't. Gene was closer to the hierarchy by, you know, a country mile than I was.
I think it was Elwood.
Oh, Elwoodson.
Yeah.
Well, it was. The fact that, you know, prior to that, they had groped around and demonstrated that they don't know, and nor do they care. They had no respect for building a Lincoln look, and I remember working with Jean Bourdonnais on the developing of a Lincoln story. If you there's some material that, you know, we got material together of the Lincolns of the past. We got material together of Cadillacs. Very, very relevant and important. When you look at those Cadillacs, they didn't just happen to look the way they did. That was all part of an intentional building of a background, a heritage. And I think that, as far as I'm concerned, the Jean Bourdonnais was the father of that, and I hope it, not that it's terribly important, I'm sure to either to me or to Gene what they think, But I you know, Ford Motor Company owes a lot of credit to Gene for the establishing of a Lincoln look in their automobiles. And Lincoln, when they accepted that, and their respect in the marketplace grew right with it, in direct proportion to it. So it was I enjoyed being, you know, having a hand in that, and I think he did a marvelous job and he met with a lot of resistance. He really did. But we you know, I look back on it, we sold a few things, that were good for the company, and everything you offer doesn't necessarily receive the kind of credits and the kind of applause that you'd like, but nonetheless, in the long pull, they were the right decision. And certainly he was a master at that. But that...
Did we talk last time about the competition for the 61 Lincoln? Did I ask you about that? I understand you and Gene and were doing one version, and
right.
The Engel team were doing another version.
Right, yes. I think it was... there was a chief, I think he was vice president of engineering, can't recall his name. I think Gene at that phase reported to this particular chap in engineering. I remember him visiting the studio and venturing an opinion about the what we were doing in clay. Veraldi, or not Veraldi, but it's almost like that.
Mm-hmm.
But he was for a short period was. In the hierarchy of engineering, and as I believe Gene...
It wasn't, you mentioned Grebe.
Yeah, no, it was, this was pre-Grebe, I think, or...
Vic Raviola. Right.
Ravioli, yeah. And we were, our package work was really originated at the direction of the leadership. I think I'm right about it being Vic Raviola. The package decision-making was had directed us to progress the car for 61 off of the 59, which was a very 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 big car, and that was where we were caught in that maelstrom of at the time that Elwood attacked with this this Thunderbird.
Right.
So it was really a devastating thing. As attractive as a car was, it's you know, to get hit with a package departure of that magnitude is.
Right. So you were stuck with the large Lincoln.
Oh yeah, we were. So it was about as, you know, it was like the, you know what, in the punch bowl. That nobody really wanted to see that car. It really was funny. So,
you were upstairs and he was downstairs. There.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was really a good operator, and very very spontaneous, and very That was a master stroke, I look back on it.
Apparently aided by McNamara's surprise visit. I said, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, that's our proposal for the new Thunderbird. I said, hell, why don't we make a Lincoln on it?
I see. Well, I never had been privy to that. I never had heard that before, but I know McNamara was, I don't think I ever met the man during my stay at Ford.
Yeah. I guess you're like a will-o'-the-wisp, sort of in and out very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a man of great snap decisions. And
yes, right, yeah.
Of course, he commuted to Ann Arbor, so he wasn't around too much.
No, that's right. I had encounters of, that were interesting to me with some of the hierarchy of the company, but never R.J. Miller and Jack Reith and people, to name two. But McNamara, I never met him, and nor did I. Do I recall having any kind of an encounter with him at all?
I guess basically he wasn't interested in styling or design. He was interested in the full package, including engineering possibilities. But I think he was more interested at this point as head of Ford Division, more interested in something that would sell.
Well, yeah, and I guess that certainly is a. That's, you would expect that. I think Mr. Iacocca would be thought of in that same, similarly, at certainly when he was at Ford, although he was, I had more involvement with him because he was probably much more interested and participated in the design process.
Right.
He's a very I think very unusual in that regard in the for CEOs. The degree to which he participates and the level of interest that he has, I could understand the CEOs having an interest in the effect of design or the effect of whatever you element you want to discuss regarding a passenger car or truck, but Mr. Iacocca's involvement is, I think, runs unusually deep for a top executive, and he's very fortunately for the companies that he's part of, and for us as creative people, he's very good at what he does,
and
very supportive.
Yeah, that's good.
And very helpful if what we're doing is not doesn't follow the directions that his judgment tells him is where it should be. We have the benefit of hearing from him. He's not a shrinking violet when it comes to letting you have the benefit of his knowledge. So it works out very well for us in the creative end.
At this point, I suspect Mr. Iacocca was just beginning to start his ascendancy in the company, with George Walker leaving and Bordenay taking over as VP of styling and Mr. McNamara leaving for the
right.
Kennedy administration. I suspect at this point was just about the time that Mr. Iacocca began his...
Yes, that would be the impression I have. Yes.
And you and Mr. Bordenay having... a good rapport with him over the years. This must have been very a fascinating period to.
It really was. I had the good fortune to be at the time. I think rather than in a division or a production vehicle studio, which I periodically I was in them. As I look at my career, the majority of it has been spent in advanced work.
Yes. Right.
And I don't know whether we were. I know we had a curious experience at Ford on the subject of advanced with that has background that I have no I don't have enough knowledge of it to know how this happened. I thought it was very unusual and novel, but the story I had heard was that Mr. Ford personally was not satisfied that the term advanced was proper. As a result, we were requested to rename the equivalent of advanced, identify it as special projects, and we did that. And I don't recall what stage we were going through at the time we're talking about right now, whether I was head of special projects or reported to Bob McGuire, exactly what the sequence was. But the key to the subject or the recollection here is that I had the good fortune to work on the laying of the groundwork for the Mustang.
Ah, yes.
And I did. I kept a ledger on that. I have a book, a black three ring binder, that has the pictures and so forth of what we did during this foundation laying, and we worked on a lot of Thunderbird, on a lot of Mustangs, a lot of wheelbases. As I've said to various people when we've talked about this, the history that we've all been involved in, that I don't disagree with the car they chose of Joe Horace's. It's nice, and it's, you know, it made history. But I had a heck of a good competitor to that car. I think, in my analysis, I wore the design out by having, I did, I don't know, somewhere 20 or more versions of the Mustang, the competitor, in search of the solution, in dimensionally searching and proportion analysis, but I tried to keep apples and apples together, and as a result, I tried not to. It became important both to me and to Bourdonnais as well that we not that we not depart from this particular design, and so I didn't. I think in some respects it had a higher level of modernity than the one they picked. It might have been criticized by some people as being more as a result of things that General Motors did later. It ended up looking more GM-like, I guess you could say. So we did really give that a. I think it worked well from the standpoint of Mr. Iacocca, as far as the search for the proper car. Would you excuse me a minute?
I guess
I would have to say, in answer to was there a competition regarding the subject, I think that I would have to say, you know, to be a little cautious, I would have to say that's Don De La Rosa. Really, I am. Although I don't think it. I would. It would appear on the surface. Nor today would I be thought of as competitive. But at that time in my career, I was, and I was a. I mean, I was really devoted to it, and. I didn't enjoy losing at all, and I was totally devoted to competing, and I liked winning. Those things, I think, with maturity or age pass. Like you know, now it's quite a different kind of world for me. But at that time, yes, I was very competitive. In fact, I enjoyed winning. I enjoyed some things that were would have to say were a little bit could be childish, could be rather irrelevant, unimportant. To me, they were important.
Sure.
I enjoyed beating. Joe Orris, for instance, at any opportunity I had. I enjoyed beating this chap whose name I don't remember, but you've mentioned him a couple of times today, Buzz Grissinger, who I don't remember him because I don't want to remember him, you know, because he's a... people that are so convinced that they are the be-all to end-all are a little bit of a problem for me, you know. And Grissinger was a, you know, he had no doubt in his mind that he was right. I had every inclination to respect him as an able designer, but I couldn't tolerate his brand of self-grandizement. I mean, it was just too much. And so, if I forget his name, I can understand why. But I, you know, so. Any of those fellows that I could beat in a design contest, I worked very hard at doing it, and I particularly like to knock off the head of Ford Studio. He was particularly fair game, and but Joe was a hard-working, dedicated, you know, a totally devoted, honest person. It's just that if you love winning, you have to, you know, he has to be sacrificed if you possibly can do it. And I don't know whether I've told you this little story about what happened with the Mustang fight.
Please do.
I think it was Mustang had grown to maybe we 64, 65, 66. It was like the 65, 66, 67 Mustang, and. Orris was with Bourdonnais's support, had somebody, and I'm sure Gene was, you know, supporting it because it seemed to make makes sense, that for orderliness and all kinds of good things, we are going to have every Mustang that is a candidate is going to be white. Somebody, you know, so that was okay. Well, I'm not necessarily proud of this, but one of the things that I saw was an opportunity here. So I had my candidate. I knew that they were at the starting line as far as the approval point was really just we had arrived at that. And Joe, typical of Joe, felt quite self-assured that it was his car. So at the last minute, I had mine painted red. Well, the unexpected happened, which was a blessing for me. In the process of, and this exists today, and it makes sense for top management to want to see all of it. You know, we do a lot internally. We look at our vehicles that are under development. We look at them as creative people. We look at them privately outside. In the winter time, this becomes a bit of a problem unless you have an unusual facility where you can create an outdoor environment. We don't have that here at Chrysler, nor did we have it at Ford. So the hierarchy of the company, somebody within it, decided that to wrap up this decision, these cars had to go outside. And so my car went outside, and it was snowing like hell. I've never seen so much snow. And of course, these electric lift devices, of course, they're not engineered at all for operating under those conditions. It was a ramped entry into the studio from the courtyard, and it was slippery, and it was snowing up to your belt line, you know. And so I was just beside myself with the humor of this, right, and plus the chance of knocking Joe off, because his car got stuck. It slipped off into the snow, and it was snow color. You know, it was white.
Yeah,
right. It was terrific. That's kind of sick, but it's kind of, you know, I thought, oh boy, and here's our red beauty there. You know, God. Yeah. But we, the fun things that you, yeah, they really are. They really are. And before we really started this interview, I would have done well to have had a up-to-date dossier on myself that really, really identifies my the dates and my past and so forth, because I don't think it's a departure of memory on my part because of my age. It's just that I have been involved in so many things, and I'm not as much of a historian, albeit an interested person in history. But I'm not I don't have the retention of things like other people that we've talked about who are, really are buffs, you know, and I respect that. They know just exactly where they were and where everything was, you know, I think it's marvelous. I have these little, glimmers of recollection about it and so forth, but I'm not as...
Well, I think that in this case, we prefer your impressionistic selective recall. So
I see.
Uncomfortable.
I see.
And not worry about chronology.
I see.
It's more important that we get your viewpoint, your version of things as they happen to you. So as far as the Mustang, then, what ensued after that momentous meeting in the snow, or presentation in the snow?
Well, I was operating, as I recall, I was involved in, continued to be involved in this whatever we were, as a result of being courteous and wisely so to Mr. Ford, as far as what were we going to be called. So I don't know whether it was special projects or advanced, but I know I do remember one of the second encounters I had with Mr. Iacocca was one that was kind of a disappointment, I'd have to say, to me, because I've always, I guess I've looked upon things that I've created when I really believe in them. I had a new Mustang. This was about 1970, 1969, 70. It was for the next generation of Mustang, and I think I could have fared much better career-wise. I'm not talking monetarily, but from the standpoint of personal satisfaction and less personal aggravation, if I had a better, more ability to deal with being turned down. Like I say, at this particular incident, this was a. I was convinced this was right for the next. I went through this two times with Mr. Iacocca. I went through it with the Fritz Mayhew doing the Mustang II. I did the Mustang II competitor prior to Fritz Mayhew, and. I had, you know, but anyway, it's another story. But this was back, this was the preceding next generation. And I had been a major contributor, if not the designer of. I always hesitate in this business to, because there's so many people that want to be, you know, it's never been my real devotion to that, but right. I think I really was. I think I did design the Torino, 1972 Torino.
Right.
But you'll probably find some three other guys that think they did it too. I don't know, heck, maybe Gene did it. But anyway, at that same time, I had an associate. He was a very, very talented Japanese-American, a fellow by the name of Tony Yuki. And we had a good relationship. And I think I'm right about this. Tony Yuki was with me when we were doing the preparation for the Mustang, these 20 to 30 cars. Tony Yuki and I worked on those. And he was a heavy contributor to this project, and I think he worked with me on this next generation of Mustang, and some years later, which I was sure was right for the Mustang of the future. Mr. Iacocca was just as sure that it wasn't. And it was scuttled. It had, you know, but as I say, that's a shortcoming of mine, is really not being able to that's, you know, stayed with me forever, and I think always will. I mean, that was a mistake that, in all his brilliance, that was a mistake he made. That car would have been, you know, gangbusters. It was fantastic. But nonetheless, that's life, you know. In the creative business, that's life. And
I've heard that story.
It was. Lee said to me, he said, "Jesus, you know." He says it's terrific. But he said it's as I recall, he said it's just, it doesn't have enough Mustang in it. It doesn't recall the Mustang enough. It's almost like it's too modern. It's too much of a departure. It was a blaster, though. I mean, it was fantastic.
Have you saved any of the sketches?
No, I don't think so. I might have some. It's possible. I've got to go through a couple of boxes of photographs. It's possible that I have some photographs of it. It has a lot. The thematic material was, I used the things that once in a while Lee gets on this, will be in a mood to give you a little short one. He'll tell you about what a hell of a questionable job that was that you did on the Torino with those fat hips, you know, that had the shape that they had on it, you know. Well, really, I used that theme and ran that theme the full length of the car. In other words, that it was a wedge. It had the hood came down. Like, they didn't have cars like this around at that time. You know? Oh, it was pure excitement, bright yellow. And God, I was disappointed when he didn't agree with me.
Yes.
That's a funny thing. I, for a placid person who's almost sickeningly agreeable, I have such a little tolerance for being disagreed with. It's amazing. I don't know where I come off with this.
Everybody has
it. I don't know. It's strange. I should be, you know, I'm almost. As I say, very so placid. Where do I come off getting upset because somebody disagrees with me? But I do in the creative business. Terrible.
You have your own worth.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess I should see a head shrinker or something.
No, not at all. Hang on.
And that hasn't changed much with age, by the way. It's interesting. It's part of the almost, you could say, part of the pleasure of the business. I mean, it's part of vitality. You know, it's it does. Yeah, yeah. I don't get any more. You know, I don't like it any better being disagreed with. But I get something. It's a little bit of a shot of adrenaline. You know, it's really funny. God, you would think at this age and I would have spun my wheels. But, you know, I meet Alex Tremulous, and of course he's loaded with it. You know, he's just like he was 30 years old. You know, it's fascinating. Some guys seem to really keep it, even, and so they're. They have an adolescence that stays with them. You know, it's amazing. Yeah, it really is amazing.
Keeps you young.
Yeah.
Has in your latter association with Mr. Iacocca, has he ever alluded to that rejected design in any private conversations?
No, he never has. He has made a remark about the hippie, in this context, physical hips, the hippie design I did on the 1972 Torino.
Very successful.
Yeah, it was very successful. Yeah.
So regarded as an.
Yeah, yeah. I really appreciate hearing that. I think it was a winner. A fellow that was, for a short time, I was associated with here at Chrysler was my nemesis at Ford, in a sense, indirectly, in that he was a fellow by the name of John Naughton.
Yes.
Naughton was head of head of Ford sales or something, and we were commissioned to defend an area of the marketplace that had been carved out by Chevrolet with their Monte Carlo. Now they were making their statement in the marketplace quite effectively for whatever, we'll just say $200 million of investment. At Ford, we were ordered to do a car defend Ford's honor, and we had about $15 million to do it with. And Naughton, who I don't think, I can't ever recall him having any respect for my end of the business at all.
Right.
And this was one of the periods where he was being himself, and he was, we did a car that was the, I'm sure there were other participants, but Bordenay and I primarily did a car that was a hell of a competitor. I knew it. Iacocca at least gave it whether begrudging or not, he gave it the nod. It was approved. I can't remember the name that Ford chose for it. But anyway, it was just bad, you know. I mean, it was just thought to be, you know, next to the worst possible thing that could happen as far as John Naughton is concerned. And Naughton, and there is a linkage in our business between sales and finance. And Naughton, through the position he took, it caused the financial fraternity at Ford to effectively